Tony, over to you for a few minutes.
Thanks, Steve, and there's nothing like a warm cuppa on a cold morning. Don't want to take over the proceedings, but we just wanted to say, on behalf of the Salvation Army, thank you so much to the community, thank you so much to those individuals who are here with us today, for the support, both material and in labour, towards our Red Shield appeal, which has been our best ever. And we're able to bring those funds back into the community to support people who are vulnerable, and so I just wanted to say thank you on our behalf.
Thanks, Tony. Now, we have a visiting guest speaker this morning, Charles Vesely. He found out on short notice that he was going to be a speaker. His boss, I presume.
No, he's not my boss.
He's not your boss? Okay, someone there. Mark Willis was to be our speaker, but yeah, he was called away and I asked him to deputise someone. So he said, yeah, I can look after that. So we welcome Charles on this beautiful cold morning to beautiful Cooma. Thank you, Charles.
I don't mind the cold. I was born in a country where in winter it's usually about minus 20, so that's okay. Some people say it's in my DNA to be cold. By way of introduction, I'm an army chaplain. I have been for the last 16 years. Prior to that, I was a parish minister in Western New South Wales and northwestern Sydney. Western New South Wales is the town of Grenfell. Some of you may be familiar with it, birthplace of Henry Lawson.
Last week,
I was the minister there for 5 years prior to someone tapping me on the shoulder and said, you know, ever thought about being an army chaplain? Before that, I was a police officer in New South Wales. I trained in law because I believed that, at that point, I thought my vocation was to be a barrister. And so I did the Barristers Admission Board course and did the bar exam. And served for a number of, as a police officer, but legally trained for a couple of Royal Commissions and finally the Independent Commission Against Corruption. So if you work for the New South Wales government in the 90s, you probably don't like me. But then God had other ideas because I realised that, eventually I realised that the gifts that I had that I thought were for the courtroom, to go and prosecute criminals and bad guys, were actually not the gifts that were meant to be used for that, but they're actually gifts to be used to preach the gospel. And as one does, I resisted for quite a while, and eventually God got me. So if you're running away from God, let me just give you a warning. You can run, but you can't hide. So God eventually got me. And candidate out of Wesley Mission, where we were actually, my wife and I and my family, we were members of Wesley Mission Congregation in Pitt Street in Sydney, and was on staff there for a little while as a student minister, and you know, did my training, become a Uniting Church minister. So that's a little bit of my background as to how I've come to you here. If you ask me on the day of my ordination, what do you think your ministry would be? I was very passionate about rural ministry. So the vision that my wife and I had was that we would work serving in rural centres, maybe even remote centres, like Grenfell or Cooma. And but again, sometimes God has other ideas and you learn things and you suddenly discover that you have other gifts. And I was doing the last of my master's degree and bumped into a guy called Peter Woodward, who I'm sure Noel probably knows, who was also doing the last of his master's degree at St Mark's in Canberra. And, you know, we're all clergy there. If you ever watch a clergy meet up, it's an interesting thing. You know, who are you? Where did you train? When were you all day? All those sorts of clergy type questions. And of course, I met Peter, and not only did we become lifelong friends, but he introduced himself to me as the principal chaplain army. And I said, oh, that sounds interesting. He says, you think so? You ever thought about being an army chaplain? I said, no. He says, good, I'll send you an email. The rest is history. When I went into the full-time army service, it was interesting because it was a very different type of ministry. And I always used to joke when I was at college that I don't do youth work. When I went through college, we had a couple of youth workers going through with me, and they were strange people, you know, long hair, and did some strange things on a Friday night in the church hall. Not for me. I look after adults, so I can talk to them, you know. Don't deal with youth. But strangely enough, I land up in the 1st Battalion Royal Australian Regiment, and I was there about a month and a half, and I came home, and I'm telling my wife some of the antics that the soldiers were getting up to. And my wife says to me, how old are these guys? And I said, oh, 18, 19. She goes, no youth work, huh? So God has a sense of humour. One of the things that I have found, though, throughout all my army chaplaincy, and I'm sure that all defence chaplains can attest to it, is it's a very unique opportunity to serve with some amazing people, at times in some amazing places. I'm a veteran of East Timor. I was in Timor in 2007, and then in 2009 deployed to Afghanistan, with 1RAR, and I've been deployed numerous times since then. But the thing that really struck me, going away with some of our young people, and the role of the chaplain becomes very pivotal. So, for example, in Timor, I'm sure you've all seen the imagery of Timor. If you haven't been there, you know what I'm speaking about anyway. How impoverished the Timorese people are. It's a very poor country. When we were there in 2007, it was a very messy country. There was still a lot of unrest and a lot of poverty. It's interesting when you get young people, young men and women, who've come out of living in Australia and all the privileges we have that we just take for granted, and they're suddenly confronted by this abject poverty. And as the chaplain, your role is often to help them make sense of some of that. I saw some amazing transformations of some of our young people who got on the plane to deploy as, you know, your fairly typical self-centred 18, 19, 20-year-olds, you know, with a sense of entitlement and privilege, within a few weeks to realise how hollow that is, and how happiness isn't about having the latest electronic gadgetry or Nintendo or whatever it was. But they saw kids absolutely overjoyed. They had a, you know, ratty old motorbike tyre and a stick to chase down the road, and that's all the game they had, to see kids, but they were still happy. So as the chaplain, you have this opportunity to inform and bring some of that into perspective for some of these young people, which is a very pivotal and formational ministry. In Afghanistan, it was a little bit of a different dynamic, because whilst you were in Timor, it was quite safe. There weren't too many dangers in that. But in Afghanistan, of course, it was a war zone, and it was quite a dangerous place. And so the perspective of life and being for many people becomes very, very different, especially for our young people. Before you deploy onto an operation like that, the defence puts you in what we call a mission rehearsal exercise, which means you go away for about a month to 6 weeks, usually in some really luxurious, isolated area. For us, it was right at the top of High Range above Townsville. And for that period of time, they throw everything at you that possibly could happen on that deployment, to basically get you to understand and train you up so that you're aware with what you're doing. It's an exercise for the soldiers, but for chaplains, it's live. It's always live. We don't play. We do it for real all the time. So you're away with these people, and you have some interesting conversations. And I'll tell you about a young guy. I'll call him Matt. He came up one day. He was sort of sitting around drinking coffee. And he was an infantry soldier, very accomplished Lance Corporal, so a junior non-commissioned officer. And he said that, he says, Padre, he says, you're a really nice bloke. He said, but, you know, to be honest with you, I think you coming with us to Afghanistan is a waste of time. And I said, okay, tell me why. He goes, I don't want to offend you. He said, no, I'm not offended. Tell me, I'm fascinated to hear why you think a chaplain going to, you know, to a live war zone deployment is a waste of time. He said, well, he says, you know, we need more guns. And every seat that's occupied by a non-fighter is a wasted seat. And I said, okay, interesting perspective. I hear where you're coming from and don't agree with you, of course, but, you know, point taken. And he said, besides that, he said, I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist. I said, oh, really? Okay. So you have a theology. No, I'm an atheist. So you have a theology. So I'm a rat bag. So I had great delight in telling him that even the fact that you don't believe in God is still actually a theology. So, anyway, time passes and we end up in Afghanistan. We're there about 2 weeks. And one of the things that I set up for our soldiers was that every evening at 20:45 or 8:45, for those of you who aren't familiar with 24-hour time, that I'd run a evening prayer service that our Anglican friends would be very familiar with, I'm sure, called Compline. And I figured it was a good opportunity at the end of the day to pray, particularly as we're coming into the night, because most nights we used to get rocket attacks, so there was an element of nervousness about going into the night. And secondly, just to finish the day off with prayer, pray for the night and pray for the day to come. And that was sort of, you know, advertised, and I had this little, you know, onesies, twosies, threesies that had come. But I said, I don't care, even if no one comes, I'll be in the chapel, at that time I'll be there in prayer. I'm going off to this particular evening, and as you can imagine, in that sort of a zone, you have areas that are blacked out, because obviously you don't want the bad people to see where you are, so all the lights are masked. And I went from the lit up area, and I had to walk across the compound through total darkness to the chapel, which I sort of knew by rote, you know, to the eyes adjust. As I walk out of the building that was lit up inside, I walk out, and here's this young guy, Matt. He says, Padre, are you going to pray? I said, yeah, you know that. But I've told him, you know, it's on the notice board, you know. 20:45, prayer. He goes, and I could see he wanted something, you know. He says, will you pray for me? Yeah, sure. Of course I'll pray for you. Pray for everybody, but you know what? The fact that you've asked, I'll pray for you specially. And I said to him, but you know what? You're messing with my head now, because you told me you don't believe in God. He says, yeah, but you do. Anyway, Matt became quite an interesting character, because he was going out on his first patrol, and it suddenly struck him that his lack of belief in God, and he was quite a smart guy, you know, he read Dawkins and a whole lot of other stuff, but he suddenly discovered that all that stuff didn't actually cut the mustard when it came to being faced with the possibility that you might actually not come back. And he'd been on the phone, because we had phone contact back to Australia, and he'd been on the phone to his grandmother, and his grandmother had been praying for him as well. So here's another war, here's my next warning. If you've got grandmothers praying, watch out. Right? Irresistible prayer. So he goes off on his patrol. He's happy that I'd prayed for him. A few days later, after his patrol, I bump into him again. I said, how'd it go? He goes, oh, yeah, it went really well. This is your prayers, Padre. I think, very glad nothing happened. But anyway, he said, I've been talking to Nan on the phone. I said, oh, really? Yeah. She said, apparently she told me to come and see you. I said, yeah. Well, what did she say? Oh, she said that apparently you'd know it, Padre. There's something about a shepherd and, you know, the Lord and the valley of death. And I said, oh, you mean the 23rd Psalm? Yeah, yeah, that's it. He goes, how can I get a copy of it? Well, I said, that's really easy. It just so happens that I have these cards printed with the 23rd Psalm on them, and I can give one to you. And he goes, oh, okay. He says, Nan also said something about a prayer, some prayer that Jesus taught his disciples. I said, oh, you mean the Lord's Prayer? He goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. This. I said, well, guess what? On the other side of that card is the Lord's Prayer. So he says, did my Nan sort of fix you up before we left? I said, no. What we take with us. I said, I'll give you one of those. He goes, yeah, can I have 8? What? He goes, can I have 8 cards? I said, yeah, well, sure. He says, I want for everyone in my section. I want for every bloke, when we go out on patrol, we're going to take these cards with us. And we're going to have them there. You know, if we get into a sticky spot, we know where we can get some help. Or as he put it, some thermonuclear protection. I said, your Nan's been praying for you, hasn't she? She goes, yeah, she said that. I said, yeah, mate, you better watch yourself. If your grandmother's on her knees praying for you in Melbourne, you're in trouble, mate. Yeah, you know, Matt came to faith, actually. It was quite amazing in his own rough way. And that leads me to my main point here this morning. You know, the scriptures transform lives. And as an army chaplain in a war zone, I can certainly attest to that. The next story I'll tell you actually is reprinted in this book, which you can get from Coorong. It was published in 2015, and it started a little project where Dr. Harris, from a retired Anglican minister and lecturer from St. Mark's, that was working with the Bible Society to put together a display that was going to go around Australia throughout 2015 of Bibles that had been to war. And I was teaching at the Defence Force Chaplains College as a senior instructor back then. And somehow he got my number, and he said, look, how can we get hold of some Bibles that have been to war? And he'd already had a bit of a collection, and we sort of had a long chat. And he had, you know, World War One, World War Two, Korea, Vietnam. He said, I've got nothing from recent times. And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, I actually have my ADF Bible that was presented to me when I became a chaplain, that I'd taken to Timor and taken to Afghanistan. And I said, you can have that. You know, it's a Bible Society Bible. I said, well, I'll give it back to you. I'll donate it back to you. And you can make it part of the display. He said, but we want a bit of a story to go with it. And I said, okay. So I went back through my diaries. I hadn't looked in my diaries for quite some time. So I was in Afghanistan in 9, and here we are in 14. So it's been a few years since I actually went back to my diaries, which was, you know, a bit of a challenge in some places. And I found an incident that had occurred on one of the times. I'd regularly go out with a CO, they call a CO's TAC party. We'd go out by road and visit all the forward operating bases, and that's how I could get around to see the soldiers on the, you know, very front lines. It's a very dangerous way to travel in Afghanistan by road, because as you've probably heard, there's improvised explosive devices, there's all sorts of things out there trying to get you. And but going out to the CO, it was a good opportunity to do that. It's a very slow way to travel as well, because you need engineers to clear the road in front of you, literally. So to travel 3 kilometres can take 3 hours while the engineers clear the road, make sure there's no devices planted there. And even so, you know, the enemy got very clever on how they planted them, so they potentially could be missed. So every time a wheel turned, potentially there's going to be a bang. So people are very, very nervous. The tension is very high. And we got to the forward operating base. We'd just been through what the boys used to call IED Alley, and it was a narrow cut through the Baluchi Valley, where there was plenty of opportunity for what we call, in infantry terms, overwatch, where you can have enemy soldiers looking down on you and taking shots at you, but also because of the narrow choke point, he was always usually charged with mines or IEDs. And the engineers cleared our way through it, and we got through it. And that night at Compline, which I don't know whether I was in the main compound in TK or whether I was back out. I was using the lectionary, so some of you who are familiar with that, I was using the lectionary as a calendar guide, basically, to which psalms I'd pick, and well, I didn't pick them, the lectionary picked them for me. And it was quite interesting because the psalm for that particular day was Psalm 31, verse 4, which really spoke volumes. It said, "Free me from the trap that is set for me and keep me safe." Now, if you can imagine, I'll paint the scene for you. You can't use white light because white light is a problem with night vision equipment and also makes you stand out and travels. You know, you can see white light from a great distance. So in a modern military context these days, we use green light because that doesn't interfere with the night vision equipment as much as any other colour. So I've got these guys sitting around me in a compound, and interestingly there was a lot of would attend evening prayer when we're out in the Badlands, as they used to say. So I've got this tiny little LED green light that I'm holding above my Bible to read the psalm, and so you've got this sort of strange green glow over, you know, and I'd read the psalm, and suddenly the words, just as we got to that verse 4, they just struck. It was just like, you know, suddenly we were hitting something here. And I just looked up and I could see these wide eyes looking at me. And afterwards, a couple of them said to me, "Did you choose that deliberately?" I said, "No, that's just the psalm that was set for today." Because we knew tomorrow we'd have to go back through IED Alley. And that was one thing they knew. As soon as you left TK, they knew by the dust that you kicked up, they knew where you were going, and they knew you have to come back. So they were laying in wait for you. But suddenly for these soldiers, that Psalm 31:4, "Save me from the traps they've set for me," became powerful words. And it was like God was there in the midst of us, in that middle of that green little glow. Here's God saying, "Hey, it's okay, I'm still in control. Regardless of what you think is happening around you, I'm still in control." And that's, again, the transforming power of Scripture into that situation. The other one I'll tell you is a bit of a funny story. We had a soldier who was a bit errant, and those of you who have served in the military know that happens sometimes, and that commanding officers eventually end up hearing charges, sitting like magistrates, if you like. And this particular soldier was a bit of a serial pest, and he'd been up before the OC, so the major, who'd heard his various transgressions, and then of course he transgressed again, and so the OC said, "Well, enough, it's going to the CO. The CO's got a lot more power to inflict far more severe punishments than majors." And so the CO looked at his record and decided that he was going to chuck him in the cells for 7 days. We're up in Townsville, so they decided they weren't going to send him down to the Defence Force Correctional Centre in Holsworthy, because that wouldn't have been very economical. So they stood up a custody party, and we held him in our cells. Now, one of the privileges you have as the chaplain is you can visit somebody who's locked up any time and as many times as you like. And the warrant officer in charge of it actually liked me visiting, because I'd go in there and I'd speak to the prisoner and sign the book to say I'd been. So he was very happy, because that meant that if the padre visited, there's an independent set of eyes, so that, you know, there can't be any, if there were any complaints or allegations made that prisoners were mistreated, well, hang on, the chaplain saw him a couple of times a day. And, you know. So I went to see this young guy. We'll call him John. John, uh, John was a rogue. He was a likeable rogue, but he was just a rogue, and obviously, you know, tipped the system too hard, and the CO had stung him for it. One of the things, of course, when you're locked up in a defence establishment, it's pretty tough. They take a uniform off you. They put you in a set of overalls, so you're not dressed like anybody like you were. You're not called private. You're suddenly soldier under sentence. And they in the cells, they have a red line. So as soon as someone comes into the cell area, you've got to jump up on your feet, stand on the red line with your toes on the red line to attention. So it's pretty you know, harsh. The other thing you don't get is you don't get any reading material. You don't get your phone to play on or anything like that. You get all your privileges have been taken away from you. The only thing you could get to do in that during that time is PT, and the PTI, you know, the physical training instructors, usually smash them, work them hard. Then they get to do drill. So one of the sergeants usually takes them for, you know, I think they can, under the writings now, they can take them for up to 30 minutes of continuous drill on the drill square, which means you're with your pack, your webbing, and you're marching up and down, turning around, back and forth with no purpose at all, but you do that for 30 minutes. And then the rest of the time you're locked up in your cell. Except when the chaplain comes. Because when the chaplain comes, you can, as the chaplain, I can sit down with this guy. I didn't have to call him, you know, soldier under sentence blogs. I could call him John and be relaxed with him and sit with him for as long as I like, because no one would ever say, hey, padre, nick off, go away, you've been there long enough. The only reading material they're allowed is a Bible. Or you know, well, religious material, the writing says. So he had a Bible in the cell. Anyway, he was trying to read it. The first day he says, padre, I've got nothing around, I've got this Bible. You'd be happy for me to read this Bible. I said, yeah, sure. It's a good idea. He says, where do you start? Because he'd started at Genesis, you know. He said, you're on the right track. I said, look, how about I give you, let's do a bit of a sort of directed study here. How about I introduce you to this guy called David? He was a king, and he was a soldier. And, you know, over the next 7 days as you're locked up in this place, how about we just look at David and, you know, I'll give you the readings and you read through David's life, and then when I come and see you can ask questions and we can have a bit of a chat about what you think about this bloke called David. So it was great. So as a soldier, he's reading about David's military conquests. Yeah, pretty good, you know, he's an honourable soldier, he didn't, you know, he could have killed Saul, but he didn't, you know, all that sort of stuff. Oh, and then we got to 2 Samuel, chapter 11. Well, that was an interesting morning. How could he do that? He broke the first rule of infantry. You do not knock off your mate's wife when he's in battle. Oh, really? But he did do that. Oh, he's a scumbag. Anyway, it was quite interesting because suddenly he started to actually realise that there was codes, there was methods of behaviour, all as he was reading about King David. And the best part of it all was, of course, I said, you know, you've read the whole Bathsheba thing, but keep reading. Because when, read the bit about when Nathan confronts David about his behaviour. And he did. And I came back the next day and I said, so what do you reckon? He goes, yeah, he stuffed up all right, didn't he? Yeah. But he did something about it. He changed. He repented. So young John, again, the transforming power of Scripture, young John, from just reading the story of David, became a model soldier, believe it or not. And certainly started to look at his life and his actions and taking responsibility for his actions. And it's funny because about 12 months later, his OC said to me, he said, you know, I'm locked up. I said, yeah. He said, into the cells went this immature, irresponsible, pain in the neck, serial pest soldier. But that 7 days, it was just amazing. He's come back. He went on to do what we call the junior leaders course, which is the course you do to become a lance corporal and seek junior NCO. And he became a responsible, grown adult man, soldier. And the OC said, he said, gee, that locking up did something. He said, but I don't think it was the locking up. He said, there was something else going on there, wasn't there? Because I noticed in the book you were assigned in there a fair bit. And I said, well, we had some long chats. And again, you're starting to see the opportunity that we as chaplains have that are just unique and amazing and that can transform people's lives. It's interesting when we get criticised sometimes that people say, you know, why do we have chaplains? You know, why do we have these religious bodies inside the Defence Force? The people who ask that question have never really served. Because even those who have no faith at all have learnt the value of a chaplain and have learnt the value of the ministry that we bring. Technically, some people, you know, if you want to put a label on it, you can call it pre-evangelism, because that's what it is. I don't go in there to proselytise or, you know, seek conversions or anything like that. No, we go in there to walk alongside the soldiers and in the other three services, the sailors and aviators, we walk alongside them in the journey where they're at, meeting them where they're at, hearing their stories and being there with them and living that life with them so that they can draw from the tradition that we come from to bring them some hope, some comfort, transformation and support in a place that's really tough. The other aspect of our job, and it's a job that I was involved in the last 4 years, I'm now the senior chief instructor or the commanding officer of the Defence Force Chaplains College, but previous to that I was at the 1st Division and Deployable Joint Force Headquarters. And one of the other things that we do as chaplains, it's a very important role, is the advice to command on ethics. And this probably helps me with my background in law, because the lawyer can go into and see the commander and say to the commander, look, it's perfectly legal within the rules of armed conflict for you to bomb that village over there. So you can crack on. But I follow the lawyer in pretty quickly, and I ask a question then. Okay, sir or ma'am, I know the lawyer's just told you it's perfectly legal because the lawyer's my mate and I had a chat with him outside, but is it ethical? Are there aspects of you bombing that village over there or attacking that village that actually would put it into a questionable ethical situation? Like, are there civilians in there? Are there women and children, non-combatants, that you haven't cleared out? You can go and bomb the enemy if you want to, but however, is that an ethical thing? Or, even more interestingly, is there another way we can achieve the outcome without actually resorting to bombing that village? And maybe we can resort to what the warfighters call non-kinetic effects. And that might be by relationships, by building good, robust relationships with some people in that village, that eventually the enemy get the hint and go, we're not wanted here, let's go away. Don't laugh, it happens. So there's another role that the chaplain can bring in to actually, that is a very unique role that we do. Because we are advisors to command, and it's a role that is developing very much so in more recent times. So if you think about, you know, we've all heard of Abu Ghraib prison. When I first heard about that, my first question was there a chaplain there? Because if there was, surely a chaplain or chaplains would have said to those MPs, what are you doing? What do you want about here? And you can read the details that there was a chaplain there, and there was actually some interesting action about that later. So that was an interesting one. But look, I've probably spoken enough. I'm happy to take any questions. I do need to say that anything I say here this morning, it's not necessarily the opinion of the Australian Government or the Australian Defence Force. So you heard that, I'm giving you that wave. You can tell I'm a lawyer, can't you? I'm happy to take any of your questions and take it from there. Yes?
Could you give us a rough couple of minutes of your history prior to 1968?
Prior to 1968, I was a small child. In 1968, those of you who know that piece of history of Central Europe would know that there was a vast change from that harsh Stalinist form of communism in Eastern Europe, in Czechoslovakia, my homeland, and there were huge reforms and lead to more of a free market economy. However, a certain Secretary General of the Soviet Socialist Party called Leonid Brezhnev didn't particularly sit comfortably with that, so he ordered Soviet tanks into Czechoslovakia, and which resulted in my parents, who'd lived well through both German Nazi occupation and then as children and then through the Soviet times, say enough is enough, and so we escaped from Czechoslovakia as refugees into Austria. And at the border, the Soviets weren't particularly kind. They didn't want to let us across. They shot at us. They do. But anyway, we got across and we came to Australia and we settled in Sydney. Interestingly, though, we were supposed to go to Melbourne, not Sydney, which means we would have gone to Bowngilla. Have you heard of Bowngilla? Funny, I worked there for 5 years. The chaplain, now that's a military camp again. But we didn't go to Bowngilla. They stopped us going to Bowngilla literally about 48 hours before leaving Vienna to come to Australia, because in 1968 was an outbreak of the Hong Kong flu, and the Bowngilla camp, and there's a pattern here, Victoria, was in shutdown, in lockdown. And they weren't taking any new arrivals. So they decided that we would still go to Australia. They'd booked a Qantas 707 to take us. So that was already booked. But instead of it going to Melbourne, it went to Sydney. And I've often reflected on the point that how an outbreak of the Hong Kong flu actually radically changed a lot of people's lives, including mine. Because had we gone to Bowngilla, we would have probably ended up living in Melbourne. My life would have been very different. Been a Victoria now, that's right. Would have been playing that strange game. So there you are. So again, I sort of look at that and see, the hand of God directing, even though we don't know it. There's the hand of God directing things. And when you look back, it's only when you look back you go, wow. Does that sort of answer your question? Any other questions?
Were your parents Christian?
My parents were, my father wasn't. My mother sort of nominally was. My maternal grandparents certainly were. I pray for him, that's right. That's what I say, yeah. Grandparents praying for you, watch out. They certainly were. My maternal grandparents were sort of noble stock, they were aristocrats, and so their faith shaped them. My grandfather was imprisoned by the Nazis because he upset them because he was giving food to Jewish families. They didn't take very kindly to that, so they actually imprisoned him and planned to execute him. Thankfully, the war stopped before that happened. So there's been a long history in my family, I guess, of looking at people through through different eyes than maybe the herd mentality that might have been around. And certainly that sort of, you know, my memories, my grandfather always instilled that into me. There's lots of little sayings I say, you know, my grandfather used to say, and they stuck with me, because he was a man of faith and a man of principle, who stood up for what he believed was right, and even though that he paid for that at times very dearly. Any other questions? Yes.
Your story about Max reminded me of an incident I heard about as a child, but I won't bore you with the details of that. My question is, do you think that the presence of chaplains in the defence forces reduces the incidence or severity of PTS?
I do, actually, because soldiers will often come to us first. Some people say that's because if they go to a doctor or psychologist, immediately there's a medical record struck and et cetera, et cetera, where they can have very off the record chat with padres or chaplains. I've been interested in the area of PTSD now for many, many years, even back to my police days. So probably for nearly three decades I've been following, you know, reading, research, etc. And I still work in an emergency services field as a consultant. So one of the things that really show that help in PTSD is the ability for people to talk out some of those things. So to answer your question in a simple way, I'd say in the first instance the answer is yes, because the chaplain provides a safe space for that member, you know, that sailor, soldier or aviator to come and talk about what they've experienced, what they've seen, what they've heard, and the chaplain, all the chaplain really needs to do is listen and provide that safe space. And I think that's a very powerful opportunity. So there has been research done on that, and certainly the research points to the positive of that, but even anecdotally in my own experience, and I'm sure Noel could back me up on that, and every other chaplain would say yes, we've had so many people who come in, sit in our office, or, you know, you go and have a coffee with somewhere and they tell their story, and that's very, very healing and therapeutic for them.
Yeah. Are you allowed to maintain confidentiality? Does the period allow you to keep confidentiality with the
people? Yes. So the obvious things, like we all, like all clergy now, there are some things we can't keep, and you know, I'm sure you know what they might be. Yes, we are given that privilege of confidentiality, and that's one of the things that's been very pivotal. As I said, if a member goes to a medical officer or a psychologist, well, by their professional rules, they need to keep records. Where I can sit with a person and have a coffee, and you know, they talk, and you know, there. If we come into areas where I may have to, you know, maybe a reportable matter, I usually, you know, warn them if I sense we're coming into that. But we also have we've produced leaflets and information, so our members know where the boundaries are as well. Yeah. Any other questions?
Not a question, but we're going to just stand in front of the crowd and say thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim.
For your conversation and for the stories. Listening to the work that you've done as a man of God before ordination, after ordination, and your stuff, just brings to me this sense. When Jesus said, "I am with you always," that's very, very clear in the work you've done.
Thank you.
He walks alongside you, and you bring blessing to people. So, we want to say thank you as a community and as a group for the stuff that both what you do and for what you shared this morning. We want to give thanks for that in God. I'm going to ask Noel if you come up, and we'll just pray over you before you head home.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lord, for chaplains and chaplaincy. Thank you for Charles and his word to us today. We pray for the ministry of chaplaincy with the ADF, but also all of the other chaplains, the emergency services, hospital, educational institutions. We seek, Lord, that you would continue to give us wisdom in how to present the gospel in real terms to real people in real life situations. And we thank you that we've had a bit of an idea of Charles's experience. But Lord, bless the proclamation of your gospel through individual people as like chaplains. So we seek your blessing with Charles and with us as we continue to serve you. In Jesus' name.
Amen. 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 Thank you.